So it's a great pleasure to have Julia Semeghini give this seminar. So Julia got her PhD at Lenz in Italy. So this is European Laboratory for Nonlinear Spectroscopy. And so now she's a postdoc in Michel Lukin's group at Harvard working on arrays of Rydberg atoms. And so she's going to tell us about some new results in that field. So please go ahead, Julia.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me here today, and thank you for being here. Today, I will tell you a few recent results from our group at Harvard. And let me start with a quick introduction about the general idea of what we do. So the general context is that of quantum science. And I believe it's a very exciting time for people studying quantum science, because over the past couple of decades, there has been a number of very interesting and very significant results in this context and spread out over different experimental platforms. The platform that in particular I've been working with is based on programmable arrays of neutral atoms. And this is a fairly new platform in this context, but it's been quite rapidly developing over the past, let's say, 5 to 7 years. And one of the reasons why neutral atoms have always been intriguing in terms of quantum science is that it's very easy to scale up to large number of qubits. So people have been looking into this platform, especially for this reason. Now, the two main directions in which we do experiments are that of quantum simulation of many body phases and of quantum dynamics. And on the other side, we use the same platform to study quantum information processing. So we're trying to see if we can actually use this same platform to create a viable quantum computer. So these are a few images from the works we've been doing since I joined the group 3 years ago. And today I will tell you a little bit about these two experiments. So the first one, we studied this spin liquid phase using frustrated lattices of Rydberg atoms. And in the second work is more related to digital quantum computation. And I will show you this new tool that we developed in this context. So this is the outline of the talk. I will start with an introduction about the platform. So I will talk about these arrays of Rydberg atoms, and then I will dive into these two experiments that I just mentioned. And at the end, I will have one or two slides with outlooks. Okay, so let's start with the platform. So what we want to do is to create these two-dimensional arrays of Rydberg atoms. And so we do that by starting with a two-dimensional array of optical tweezers. So these optical tweezers are simply tightly focused laser beams that are used to trap single atoms. And they are generated using a spatial light modulator. So this object allows us to create intensity profiles with arbitrary geometries by imprinting a desired phase profile onto a single laser beam. So we start with a single laser beam, we shine it onto the SLM, and then we create a desired array of tweezers by choosing the phase profiles, the phase profile that we are imprinting on the beam. So what we do here is to focus this pattern that you see in this image here at the center of a vacuum chamber. And here we have a magneto-optical trap of rubidium 87 atoms. And once we shine the tweezers onto them, I see there's a question.
I have a question about this two-dimensional array of optical tweezers. Mm-hmm. These tweezers generate a twisted light or what?
Sorry, they're generated by what?
Twisted light. Twisted light.
I don't know what you mean by twisted light, but they are generated by this SLM. So okay. It's a holographic technique.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so once we shine these onto the MOT, we start trapping single atoms into the tweezers, and we have about 50% filling fraction. And you see what you see in this image is a picture that we take of the atoms, and you see we have about 50% of the traps that contain a single atom, and 50% of them are empty. Now the question is, can we deterministically fill a subset of these traps in an ordered way? So for example, can we fill these 300 sites? So this left half of the array. To do that, we add a second set of tweezers that are this time generated by acousto-optical deflectors that basically allow us to have these tweezers that are movable in the two-dimensional plane due to how the acousto-optical deflector works. This allows us to move the tweezers around. And so what we want to do here is to shine a tweezer on top of an atom that we initially trapped, but in a trap that we're not interested in, for example, this one. And then we move the tweezer and we drop the atom off in a final site that was initially empty, but we want to fill, as I'm showing here in the picture. So by doing this in parallel over many different atoms at the same time and completing this sorting procedure, we get to something like this. So you see that most of these traps on the left side are now filled. And here I'm showing you a few different experimental repetitions. This is also more or less the repetition rate that we have in the experiment. And what you see here is that we have about 99% filling of the desired traps. The nice thing about this procedure is that it's very flexible. And so it allows us to arrange the atoms into different geometries as you're seeing here in these examples. And our favorite way of showing this flexibility is to show this video that we created with an atomic Mario, where basically each frame of this video is created by rearranging the atoms into different configurations. So what I wanted to show you with these first slides is that the first key element of this experiment is the ability to create these two-dimensional arrays of neutral atoms with programmable geometries. So you can easily see that depending on the type of experiments that we want to do, we have this possibility of choosing different geometries for the atoms in 2D. Now, these atoms are a few microns away from each other in these tweezer arrays, and so they don't naturally interact. But if we want to study many-body physics, we would like for them to interact. And so there's this second element that we need to add. How do we create interactions? So to do that, we start from the atoms in a ground state. And then we use an optical transition to excite them to a Rydberg state, which is simply this highly excited electronic state where the effective size of the atoms is now much larger than the initial size. And so the atoms in this state interact with each other through strong van der Waals interactions. And these scale as 1/6 power. Now, if we consider a pair of atoms at a certain distance r, until the atoms are far from each other and we have this optical transition on the atoms, we can excite one or both of them to the Rydberg state, as you see in this diagram here. But when we put them close to each other, the energy of the doubly excited state is shifted up due to the presence of these van der Waals interactions. And so what you see here is that the excitation of both atoms into the Rydberg state is not energetically allowed anymore. You don't have enough energy to get there. So this is what we call the Rydberg blockade mechanism, which simply tells you that if you have two atoms within a certain distance from each other, they cannot be simultaneously excited to the Rydberg state, but only one of them can be. And this characteristic distance is provided by the blockade radius, which is defined by this condition that the interaction energy is of the same order of the Abbe frequency of the transition. Okay, so with this, we have the second element. By exciting the atoms to a Rydberg state, we can get strong long-range interactions between the atoms, and actually we have a control over them by turning on and off this optical transition that does the coupling to the Rydberg state. Now, in the next slide, I want to show you a simple example of how this mechanism, that is the Rydberg blockade, which is a fairly simple mechanism, allows us to generate interesting quantum many-body phases. And as a simple example, we start from the square lattice. So here we have about 250 atoms in a square lattice. And now what we do is we shine lasers onto the atoms such that we have this coupling from the ground to the Rydberg state with the Rabi frequency omega and a tuning delta from the Rydberg state. And now this is the Hamiltonian that describes the many-body system that we get. So we have a drive term where sigma x is the operator that couples G with R, and it's proportional to the Rabi frequency of the transition. Then we have the tuning term where Ni is the occupation of the Rydberg state at a side I of the lattice, and delta is the tuning. And finally, we have the interaction term, the van der Waals interactions between Rydberg atoms. Now let's consider the situation where the blockade radius is like this. So if we have an atom in the Rydberg state here, its four nearest neighbors are all blockaded. And now we can ask ourselves, what is the many body ground state of the system when we have a positive detuning for the optical transition? So from the Miltonian here, you see that to minimize the energy, you would like to maximize the number of Rydberg excitations because we have this negative term here. But we have this constraint that is related to the blockade radius. So the way to maximize the number of excitations correspond to the antiferromagnetic state, where the Rydberg excitations that are marked here with these red circles occupy this checkerboard pattern. Okay, so this is a simple example that I wanted to show you just to highlight how this simple mechanism that is the Rydberg blockade allows us to access non-trivial many-body phases like the antiferromagnetic state in 2D. And this is something that we studied in this paper from last year where we studied the phase diagram of the square lattice, and is also related to this other work from Antoine Bravo's group in Palaiseau, where he also studied the physics of the square lattice. Okay, so with this, I hope I gave you a good enough introduction to the platform. So if you have any questions about this, so it might be the right time to ask them. Otherwise, I will start with the first experiment about spin liquids. Okay, so first of all, let me quickly introduce you what is a spin liquid and why are we interested in studying it. So this is a phase of matter that was initially introduced by Anderson about 50 years ago with the first work in the 70s. And the system he was considering there was a system of spin one-off particles with antiferromagnetic interactions on a frustrated lattice. So for example, a triangular lattice, as I'm showing here. So if you have antiferromagnetic interaction, you would like the spins to be anti-aligned with their neighbors. And you can easily see that if you're on a triangular lattice, you have this situation arising. So if you choose the orientation of these two, you see that there is no good way of choosing the orientation of the third, because each way you, if you put it up or down, you will be parallel with one of the neighbors, which is not what you want to minimize the energy. So this is what we call geometrical frustration. And Anderson's idea was that the spins would form these entangled pairs or dimers, where the state of the pair is a superposition of up, down, and down, up. And all the spins in the system would form these pairs, these dimers, and you can easily see that there is not a unique solution for the pairing of the spins. Here I'm showing one of them, but the spins can pair up in many different ways. So in his proposal, the many-body ground state of the system would be the macroscopic coherent superposition of all the possible dimer coverings of the lattice. And this is what he called the resonating valence bond state, which corresponded to what he called the quantum spin liquid, where the liquid idea was that this is clearly not a solid because we don't have a spatial order for the spins. And you have that these dimers are basically fluctuating between different orientations. And so this looks more like a liquid of spins. Okay, so at the beginning, nobody really cared too much about this proposal from Anderson, but then in the following years, people started noticing a lot of very interesting and very peculiar properties that this phase has. And as I was mentioning, there is no spatial order, but instead the type of order that exists in this phase is of topological nature. This phase has long-range quantum entanglement throughout the entire system. The type of quasi-particle excitations that exist here have these exotic anionic statistics. And among the many things, I want to mention the last one here in the list, which is one of the reasons people got very excited and very interested in these spin liquids is the potential application to implement robust quantum computation. And the idea is to take advantage of the robustness of these topological states to create more robust topological qubits. And a famous example in this sense is the toric coil model from Kitaev. So for all these reasons, people have been studying this in theory, but also have been trying to observe this phase in experimental systems. But it's very hard to observe this in condensed matter systems. And a lot of claims have been made, but all of them are very controversial, at least to my understanding. And so I would say that there has been no conclusive direct experimental evidence of this phase in an experimental system. So what happened last year is that a few theorists at Harvard started to look into the possibility of creating this quantum spin liquid phase using Rydberg atom arrays. So what is the idea of the model they proposed? So as I mentioned before, to see the spin liquid, we want to have frustration. And so they chose a specific type of frustrated lattice, which is this that I'm showing here. This is a so-called Ruby lattice, but more easily, it corresponds to a Kagome lattice, where the atoms, instead of being on the vertices of the Kagome lattice, are placed on the links at the center of the links of the lattice, as you can see here. So what you want to do on top of choosing this particular geometry is to engineer the parameters of the system such that the blockade radius is as follows. So we have, if we have a Rydberg atom here, its six nearest neighbors are all blockaded. And this gives you a constraint on the maximum density of Rydberg excitations that you can have in the system, which is 1/4 of the total number of atoms. So you can easily see it's 1/4 because if you look at each vertex of the Kagome lattice, you see there are four atoms around it, and only one of them can be excited at a time. So this constraint on the density allows us to do a mapping between this Rydberg Hamiltonian on the Ruby lattice to the dimer model of the Kagome lattice, where the idea is that a Rydberg excitation is mapped onto a dimer that connects the two neighboring vertices. Okay. So let me highlight this one more time. When I see that it maps onto a dimer, this is not made of two spins as I had before in Anderson's model. It's just a mapping where a single atom in a Rydberg state corresponds to a dimer. But why is this model interesting? So this corresponds to a dimer model of the Kagome lattice because the constraint on the density tells you that two dimers cannot touch each other, which is what you would have if they were actual dimers. So each vertex of the Kagome lattice can be touched by a maximum of one dimer. And the reason why this model, this mapping is exciting is because it was known in the literature that dimer models of Kagome lattice have spin liquid phases. So when they realized this mapping, they were very excited. And so they started to do simulations and they saw that there is indeed a range of parameters where there exists a quantum spin liquid state, which again correspond to the coherent superposition of all the possible dimer coverings. So the way you should think about this spin liquid state is, as I'm writing it down here, we have a coherent superposition of all these dimer coverings of the lattice. That in our case are these configurations of Rydberg excitations. In their paper, they also proved that this state has Z2 topological order. And so what we did in the experiment was exactly analogous to what I showed you before for the square lattice. We illuminate the atoms with this laser light that couples the ground to the Rydberg state. And then we do a state preparation that I will show you in the next slide, and we look at the final result. So here is an example of what we find at the end of the state preparation. And here I'm highlighting the Rydberg atoms with the dimers according to this mapping that I just introduced. So here I want you to notice two first things. The first one is that this is a pretty good dimer covering. So the density is close to 1/4. And you can see that because if you look at each vertex of the Kagome lattice here, you see that most of them are touched by exactly one dimer. And we have a few defects here and there where we, for example, here there's a dimer missing, here there's another one that is empty, and so on. But this looks like the state we wanted to prepare, at least, you know, from a single image. And the second thing that I wanted to mention is that you can easily see here that there is no obvious or trivial spatial ordering of the dimers. This looks pretty much disordered, and every time we repeat the experiment, we get a different configuration. Okay, but now let's get a little bit more, let's get into more details, and let's look first of all at what is the state preparation that we do. So we want to do a quasi-adiabatic state preparation. And the way we do that is by slowly turning on the Rabi frequency of the transition. So we slowly turn on the lasers that do the coupling. And then we start with a negative detuning for the transition such that the atoms are all initially in the ground state. If the tuning is negative, is large and negative, you don't have enough energy to excite to the Rydberg state. So everything is in the ground state. And then we perform this cubic sweep for the detuning, so that we slowly go from a negative to a positive detuning, and so we allow for more and more excitations slowly. So what we do here, so basically what we're doing here is we're slowly changing the Hamiltonian, because we're changing the detuning term of the Hamiltonian, and we're doing a quasi-adiabatic state preparation, trying to let the system follow the ground state of the instantaneous Hamiltonian that we have. So what we do here is we stop the cubic sweep at different final detunings, and we measure the density of Rydberg excitations. And we see that this grows from almost zero at negative detunings, and then it goes up. And when it reaches this 1/4 filling, it slows down. So this is the target filling that we were looking for the spin liquid phase. But at this point, the question is, how do we know if this is actually spin liquid? How can we measure it? So the tricky thing about topological phases is that they cannot be characterized using local observables. So we need to be able to probe highly non-local correlations. And to do that, we measure topological string operators that you might be familiar with if you're familiar with the toric code model from Kitaev. So these string operators are associated with any Z2 quantum spin liquid, as is the toric code. If you don't know anything about the toric code, no worries. I will introduce these string operators for our specific model in a second. So the first one that we want to measure is a diagonal string operator that we call Z. Is this string looks like this. So it crosses perpendicularly the bonds of the Kagome lattice. And the diagonal string operator corresponds to measuring the parity of dimers along the string. So every time we cross a dimer, we get a minus one. Every time we cross an empty bond, we get a plus one. And so, for example, for this small string that I'm showing here, we get an expectation value of minus one. Now, this is the smallest closed Z loop that you can draw on the Kagome lattice that encloses a single vertex. And you can easily see that for any perfect dimer covering, so where the density is exactly 1/4, and you have exactly one dimer per vertex, this will always be minus one. One dimer means minus one. Now, if you extend this argument to a larger loop, you see that for a perfect dimer covering, again, density exactly 1/4, any larger loops correspond, the expectation value on any larger loop needs to be minus one to the number of vertices enclosed, because for each vertex inside, you get a dimer. And so you can only have either plus one or minus one, depending on the parity of vertices inside the loop. So we want to measure this to see if we, to check that we are in this dimer phase. And so what we do is we take a snapshot, as I showed you before, we identify the Rydberg atoms, and then we start measuring this parity on closed loops. So for example, here we draw this loop around a single, let's say, star of the Kagome lattice. And here you see, for example, we cross two dimers, so the parity here is plus one, is minus one times minus one. Then we move the loop around and we average over different locations of the loop. And we also average over many different experimental repetitions. And here is what we get for these two loops that I'm showing here. So a negative detuning, you see that we have a finite expectation value for both loops. And this is a trivial result of the fact that here the density of Rydberg excitations is very low. So you could imagine that here we have an array that basically has very few dimers in it. So typically when you draw this closed loop, it won't cross any dimers. So the expectation value would be plus one. So most of the times that's positive. And so on average, you get a positive expectation value. But now when you increase the detuning and you get to positive values, you see that this starts to average down to zero because the density becomes larger. So this becomes a very disordered situation where sometimes you get plus one, sometimes you get minus one, and on average you get zero. But here, when the density gets close to 1/4, the expectation value actually becomes finite again. And another interesting thing here is that the sign for these two loops is different. And the reason for that is that in this loop here, we have 6 vertices inside, whereas in this one, we have 11. So according to this rule here, we would expect indeed a different sign for the two. Now we measured this for loops of different sizes and shapes as I'm showing here. And you see that for all these loops, we get a finite expectation value on a finite range of the tunings. And this allows us to conclude that we are indeed observing the transition into an approximate dimer phase. I call it approximate because, of course, you can see that the expectation values are not plus one and minus one. As I told you at the beginning, we would expect for a perfect dimer covering, but they are finite, which means that we have a dimer phase with a finite density of defects. So that's why I call it approximate. But now what I told you at the beginning was that the spin liquid phase should be the coherent superposition of many different dimer coverings. So how do we know if we have that? How do we know if we have the coherent superposition? To do that, to measure that, we need to introduce the second string operator, which is an off-diagonal operator that we call X. And this is how it is defined. So what this X operator does is to shuffle the dimers around. And so this is a possible definition for the X operator. This is the one we chose. So the X strings run along the bonds of the Kagome lattice. And here it's how the X operator acts on a single triangle of the Kagome lattice. If you apply X on this side, if you don't have any dimers on the triangle, you will create one on that side where you're applying X. If you have a dimer there, you will annihilate it. And if you have dimers on the opposite sides of the triangle, you will swap the position. Okay, so now if we apply this definition to the action of X on a closed loop, as I'm showing here, what this closed X loop does is to map a dimer covering into another dimer covering. So for example, if we start with this dimer covering here and we apply X on this loop, looking at this definition. So if we apply X on this side, we're gonna remove this dimer. We apply here and we create one here. We remove this one, we create one here. And so we end up with this complementary dimer covering. Now, on this case here, instead, we're swapping the position of all the dimers. And so we end up again with the complementary dimer covering and so on. So this X does this thing to map dimer coverings into other dimer coverings. This means that if we measure X on closed loops and we find a finite expectation value, this implies that the initial state had a coherent superposition of the different dimer coverings that are mapped by this, that are connected by this specific loop. Hope it makes sense because this is an important thing. So you can see that measuring X on closed loops now become our smoking gun to see if we have coherence in our state. So how do we measure this? This is an off-diagonal operator. So to measure it, we need to do a basis rotation where basically we measuring X corresponds to applying a certain basis rotation and then measuring Z on dual strings. So the dual string for this X string is this Z string that is parallel but crosses the two sides of the triangle. And it turns out that you can do this Bayes' rotation by performing a quenched time evolution of your state for a certain time tau, where the quenched Hamiltonian corresponds to the usual Rydberg Hamiltonian, the same that I showed you before, but with a different blockade radius. So if you remember at the beginning, I told you that the blockade radius needed to enclose the six nearest neighbors. And here instead, we reduce the blockade radius such that it only covers the atoms within the same triangle. So this is highly non-intuitive, and so you need to trust me on this. But if you do this specific time evolution, you apply this quench and you evolve for a certain time tau, you will get the Bayes' rotation that you need to measure X as measuring Z on dual strings. So the way we do it in the experiment is we do the state preparation that I showed you before, and then we apply the quench, where to change the blockade radius, we need to change omega. As I told you at the very beginning, when I was introducing the Rydberg blockade, the blockade radius corresponds to the condition where the interaction energy is of the same order of omega. So by changing omega, we can change the radius. And so what we do here is to increase omega to reduce the blockade radius. And here, one detail that could be interesting for experimentalists is that to change the blockade radius of this amount, we need to change omega by a factor of 14, which means that we need to increase the laser power that does the Rydberg coupling by a factor of 200. And this was one of the most challenging aspects of this experiment. Anyway, we apply the quench, we evolve for the specific time tau that was predicted by the theory, and so we can measure X. And here I'm reporting the expectation values for X on these different loops. And you can see that we have a finite range of the tunings where we get a finite expectation value as we want it, which means that we're indeed observing signatures of coherence between different dimer coverings in the state we're preparing. So this is great. This is what we were hoping for. So, with these two measurements of Z and X on closed loops, we verify that we have a dimer phase, that we have a coherent superposition of many different dimer coverings. But now there is one last thing that we need to check to prove that this is a spin liquid. And this thing is comparing closed loops and open strings. And here I'm going to tell you why in a second. So here I'm showing you the comparison between the closed string that I already showed you before, this one with six vertices inside, and the open string that corresponds to half of this. Now, what you see here is that in the trivial region that I identified before, both of them have a finite expectation value. But then in what I just identified as the dimer phase, the open string goes to zero, whereas the closed loop has a keeps to a finite value. In a similar way, the X operator, we see that for the open string, this is finite at lower the tunings, but then it goes to zero when the closed loop remains finite. So the idea here is that closed loops are the ones that allow us to detect non-trivial topological correlations, where the open strings are the ones that allow us to distinguish the quantum spin liquid phase that we're interested in from trivial nearby phases. For example, it's crucial to see this difference here. Otherwise, we would have a false positive here on this side. Okay, this is the idea. So what we do here is to put all these observations together. We identify the region where all these conditions are fulfilled. So closed loops have a finite expectation value, but open loops have a zero expectation value. And we can identify the region where we see the onset of a quantum spin liquid phase. So this is great. As I mentioned, this is the first direct evidence of a quantum spin liquid phase in any experimental system. And now in the next couple of slides, the last ones on this experiment, I want to show you what I mentioned at the beginning, which is that these spin liquids can be used to create topological qubits. And so I just want to show you what is the idea here and what are the first steps that we did in this direction. So first of all,
Sorry, yes. Julia, can I ask a quick question? So you probably explained it already, but I'm just slow. So when you say that you are, when you talk about these expectation values, so this is averaging over what?
This is averaging over different locations of the loops that we're measuring or the string
In a single experiment.
So in a single experiment, we average over different locations of the loop, but we also average over many, many, many experimental repetitions.
I see. But so in a single experiment, is this pattern static? Or like, so this, if you take a single experiment, is this dimer pattern static or is not?
What do you mean static?
Well, so in a single experiment, are the dimers fixed to specific bonds, or is it still a coherent superposition?
He's asking whether you're also doing a time average.
Sorry, I think so. The way I understood the question is, what we are concluding is that we have a coherent superposition. When you do the measurement, you are always projecting into the Z basis. So you always get, for each experimental repetition, you get a single dimer configuration because you're projecting down. Even if you had an initial coherent superposition, you always project. It's the same thing that you would have for any quantum state. When you measure, you're projecting into a specific, you're breaking the superposition, right?
Okay. Okay.
So we do this measurement of the X operator to test if there is coherence, because this is, it's like, it's the same thing that you would do if you want to measure a best state pair. If you measure in the Z basis, you only know that 50% of the time you have zero and 50% of the time you have one. So you want to measure the coherence by doing a basis rotation to see that before projecting you had a coherence superposition.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, I have a question. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. I think Anton's question was, what is the dynamics? Is there an intrinsic dynamics of the Rydberg atom? Or how do you prepare the coherent superposed state to begin with? You described some scheme. I didn't understand it.
So the way we do the state preparation, so we expect this state to be the ground state of this Rydberg Hamiltonian for a certain positive detuning, right? So the way...
How do you ensure that? No, because it is difficult to create a coherently superposed state. So how do you create that superposed?
Yeah, so the idea is this state should be the ground state of the Hamiltonian, right? That's what the theory showed us. So what we want to do is to prepare the ground state of the Hamiltonian. And the way we do that is by doing this quasi-adiabatic state preparation, where we start from an Hamiltonian that we can perfectly prepare the ground state of. And then we slowly change the Hamiltonian, trying to have the system follow the ground state of the Hamiltonian. Of course, it's not perfect, which is the reason why we have defects. But that's the way we're doing it.
I see. So you are saying it's possible to prepare your coherent superposition experimentally, starting with a frozen state, a configuration of Rydberg atoms. I see. That is not obvious. Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Sorry. If I can interrupt one more time. So what is the temperature compared with, for example, the rings change in the dimer model?
So the temperature here is not a well-defined quantity. The thing we can characterize is, for example, the density of defects that we have. It's not a thermodynamic limit. You cannot really define the temperature. The only thing we can actually measure is how non-adiabatic we were when we did the state preparation. And so that is characterized by measuring the density of defects we create. Does that make sense?
Can I ask a related question?
Sure.
Yeah, so this is not in an equilibrium.
What do you mean it's not equilibrium?
It's omega is a function of time. So yes. I thought that it's not equilibrium the terminology of ground state is not very clear to me.
So we are tuning omega and then we stop. At the end, we stop. So omega at the end of the state preparation is fixed. So in that sense, it's equilibrium. Of course, we are driving the system. The optical transition is still on. So it's the ground state of that Hamiltonian that has a drive term in it. Does it make sense? So we tune it with time to do the state preparation, but then at the end, we there's nothing that is time dependent. It's the time dependence is just for the state preparation. Does it answer your question?
Yeah, I'll think about it. Thank you.
Okay. Can I ask you? Can I trouble you one more time? So, sure. Do you think that you are creating equal amplitude superposition, or you have no information about that?
So we don't really have a direct way to measure the amplitudes. The picture that we have is that the spin liquid you expect to create, if you were exactly preparing the spin liquid, would be an equal amplitude superposition. And basically, when you have defects that correspond to M anions in the spin liquid, you expect to have that some of these amplitudes become minus one instead of plus one. And that corresponds to having anionic excitations. So when you measure the expectation value for these X operators, you have the amplitude is decreased from one to something smaller. And we have no ways of measuring the exact amplitudes, because it's a global measurement. So we measure different amplitudes at the same time when we measure X.
Another question is, you are saying that you reach this quantum spin liquid when delta by omega is around 4.
Mm-hmm.
What happens before and after? So, you know, it's not like there's a phase transition or anything, right? So you finally tune some parameter that you reach that, then what happens?
What happens
close,
at a large
close by delta by omega?
So in the theory, what the theory observed was that at larger delta over omega, there should be a valence bond solid. We don't really see that. What happens for us is that you basically get to larger densities that are larger than 1/4, because the blockade picture that I showed you before, if you increase the tuning, you're able to fill that gap that allows you to excite more. Mm-hmm. And so the density can actually grow beyond 1/4. So what we see, if you want, I can go back to that plot, but we see that it goes to 1/4 and then it starts increasing again. So there we see that we start having dimers touching each other. So we're going out of this
dimer
subspace, yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Anything else?
Sorry, Julia, I have a very brief question. So suppose you have an empty lattice with one Rydberg excited atom. What is its dynamics? Will it start moving, or do you have a control over the dynamics?
What is the dynamics of what?
Suppose I have an excited Rydberg atom.
Mm-hmm.
Will the excitation get transferred to the neighboring unexcited atom? Is there a small probability for that?
Not really. We don't have, you don't have tunneling or hopping. So when you excite that atom, it typically stays there. In the image of this resonating valence bond state, it's a fluctuation in the sense that you have the superposition, but it's not tunneling, it's not moving around.
So you impose dynamics. There is no intrinsic dynamics. You force like certain number of Rydberg atoms to move in a correlated way. That's okay.
Yeah.
To create what you want as a coherent superposition.
Because
this is an unusual dynamics for theorists like us, because
okay
so you are, yeah, please go ahead. Thank you.
No problem. Okay, so let me get into this in the next few minutes, and then I will switch to the second experiment. So the idea here is, how do we create a topological qubit? And the first thing, if you want to create a topological state, is to have an array with non-trivial topology. So for example, you want something with a hole, basically, with at least a hole. So what we do here is to create a hole at the center of the array by removing a few atoms here. And when you do this, what happens is that you create two distinct topological sectors for your dimer coverings. So here I have three examples of dimer coverings. And you can see what I mean with the two distinct topological sectors by looking at this quick example. So if I superimpose these two dimer coverings, and then I remove the dimers that are overlapping like this, I'm left with a few dimers that are basically showing you what is the transformation that you need to do to go from one to the other, from this to this, or vice versa. You would need to swap these dimers that are left here. Now, if I do the same thing for these two, what you see is that I'm left with a few dimers again, but the main difference is that these dimers here form a closed loop around the hole. Now, if you imagine this array to be larger and the hole to be bigger, this means that to do the transformation, you need to involve a large number of dimers and to do a very non-local transformation, because you need to go around the hole that is a very physical fixed limitation. So this is what we mean when we say that these two are in opposite topological sectors. Basically, the transformation between two dimer coverings in opposite sectors involves a large number of dimers, and it's very non-local. And instead, these ones are in the same topological sector, because to do the transformation, you only need to involve a few dimers and to do a local operation. So once we have defined the two topological sectors, we can define the two logical states of the qubit, 0 and 1, as the spin liquids that live in one or the other topological sector. So 0 is the superposition of all the dimer coverings in one sector, and 1 is the superposition of everything in the other sector. So now we can define logical operators for this qubit, where sigma z corresponds to a z string that connects the hole with the outer boundary. And this is a good z operator because sigma z operator, because if you look at any of these z string from the hole to the boundary, you will see that for any dimer covering into the same topological sector, the expectation value is the same, but in the opposite topological sector, it's the opposite. And so the eigenstates of this operator are the 0 and 1 logical states with eigenvalues plus and minus 1. And for sigma x, we choose an x loop. It could be any x loop that goes around the hole. And this has eigenstates plus and minus, which are the superposition, the symmetric and antisymmetric superposition of 0 and 1. So what we do in the experiment is we perform the same state operations as should be before for this array with the hole. And then we measure sigma x and sigma z. So this is what we get. And in the quantum spin liquid region that we identified before, what we find is that sigma z has a 0 expectation value, whereas sigma x is finite. So the state we're preparing has a finite overlap with the plus state here, because the 0 sigma z is compatible with the superposition of these two, and the positive sigma x is compatible with this. Again, it's a small overlap, if you wish, because this is not 1, as we would expect for a perfect plus state, but still, that's the state that we're getting close to. So as I was mentioning, these are really the first steps toward the creation of a topological qubit. What one would want to do next is to show how you can, well, first of all, get a better state preparation, but also how you can manipulate and encode the qubit and do quantum operations with it. And so this is what hopefully will come next. And this work was related to another project from the Google group that was published in the same number of Science as Ours, where they created toric code states using their superconducting qubits. Okay, with this, I'm done with this part. So if you have any last questions on this, well, you can ask them later too, but this would be a good time. Otherwise, I will get into the next part. Okay, so this second experiment, as I was mentioning, is more related to digital quantum computing. And the main question that we want to ask to answer here is, how can we achieve non-local connectivity through the array? And this is a problem that is common to any quantum platform, because typically the way you achieve entanglement is by taking advantage of some local interactions. And so the entanglement usually happens between nearby qubits. So how can you achieve non-local entanglement? And there have been many different approaches proposed in the literature, for example, having a quantum data bus, for example, with atoms in a cavity. The cavity can mediate interactions between all the spins, or with using shared motional modes for ions, et cetera. Or you can have a quantum network where you have different quantum systems that are connecting, for example, in this case, by photons, et cetera. And finally, there was this idea of a quantum ion CCD, where the ions can be moved around to transport entanglement through the array. And the architecture that I will show in a second is actually very similar to this quantum ion CCD idea that was recently demonstrated by the Honeywell group. Okay, so what we do in our system is well represented by this picture. So we have our array of atoms. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we have these movable tweezers. And up to now, we've always used these movable tweezers just to initialize the array, and then we leave them where they are. But now what we're doing is to use the movable tweezers also during the quantum operations, the quantum dynamics. So for example, what we do here is we put these two atoms close to each other to perform an entangling gate, but then we pick one atom up using one of these tweezers and we move it close to another atom to perform a second entangling gate. So to be able to do this in a proper way, there are a few ingredients that need to be introduced. The first one is we only use the Rydberg excitation to generate entanglement, but then we always map down the qubit states to two hyperfine states. So this is represented here in this scheme. The qubit state 0 and 1 are two hyperfine states of rubidium, and we use the excitation to the Rydberg state only shortly to generate to have strong interactions and generate entanglement, but then we always map down to this 0 and 1 states. And the reason for that is that whereas the Rydberg atom has a limited lifetime, it's interacting, it's not as reliable. The hyperfine qubit has a very long coherence time of more than a second. And also the atoms in those states are non-interacting. So when you do the movement, you don't need to be worried about them talking to each other. They just don't see the other atoms. So you can do any trajectories that you want. And as I was mentioning, we use these optical tweezers to move different atoms in parallel. So with this, we wanted to demonstrate that we can actually use this tool to transport entanglement through the array. And I will show you this in a second. So the first test that we did was to prepare 8 pair of atoms, as you see here. We entangled them. We entangled the atoms in each pair with each other. We prepare a Bell state. And then we separate the atoms in the same pair by 100 microns. And we measure the Bell state fidelity before and after the movement. And here I'm showing you the results for the two atom parity, which measures the coherence of the Bell pair. And you can see that before and after the movement, this is basically unchanged within the error bars. We don't see any visible change, which means that the coherence is preserved when we move the atoms by 100 microns in a few hundred microseconds, which is much faster than the T2 time of 1 second that I showed you before. So this got us very excited. And we started thinking of what are the applications of this? What can we do with this new tool? So in this paper that we recently posted on the archive that was just accepted by Nature, we use this tool to do different things. Most of them are in the direction of digital quantum computing. So for example, we prepared a 1D cluster state, a two-dimensional quantum error correcting code that is the STINC code, the surface and toric code in 2D and 3D. So we can actually prepare a 3D torus even if our atoms are in 2D, because moving the atoms, we can actually close the boundary conditions of the torus. And finally, we did another thing that doesn't have to do with this digital quantum computation, but it's more, it has application for quantum simulation experiments, that is the measurement of entanglement entropy. Basically, what we did there was to create two copies of a one-dimensional system, and then we can put them close to each other and perform, and let the twin atoms in the two copies interfere with each other to measure entanglement entropy. But I don't have time to go into the details of that. So if you're interested, you can look it up here, or we can talk about it later. So of all these, I just want to show you one example to show you how this tool works, and hopefully to demonstrate that it actually opens a broad range of new directions of things we can do with this machine. So the example I chose, also in connection with the first work that I showed you about spin liquids, is the preparation of a toric code state. So the idea here is to introduce a distinction between ancilla and data qubits, where basically the toric code state is formed by the data qubits that are in black here, but we can introduce an ancilla qubit at the center of the star of the cross here to mediate entanglement between the four atoms, even if they never directly interact with each other. So the four black atoms never get close to each other enough to interact. But we use this ancilla atom in the center to move close to each of them in following steps, and to perform a sequence of entangling gates such that we can create the connections that you see here. So the edges here correspond to entangled pairs. So this is what we do. We initialize each qubit in a superposition state. Then we perform these four entangling gates with the ancilla and each atom of the cross, and then we project the state of the central ancilla atom to prepare the desired toric code state. So here I'm going to show you a video to show how this works to the atom movement. And here what you see is that we have the data qubits in static traps, whereas the ancilla qubits are trapped in these movable tweezers, and they will move around to perform this sequence of entangling gates. When you see these red circles, it means that those two atoms in the circle are being entangled. So we start with entangling these eight pairs, and then we start moving the ancilla atoms around. Second entangling gate, third, fourth, we have a fifth, and then we move the atoms up. And we do this, we separate the ancilla atoms from the data qubits such that we can do at the end a readout of the two groups of atoms in different bases. Basically, we shine a laser on one of the two groups to apply Bayes' rotation such that we can do the readout in different bases. So by doing this, and here I just want to show you quickly the results, we can measure the stabilizers for the toric code that I'm showing here. So these are the expression values for the X plaquettes and for the Z stars. And here on this side, we have the expectation values for the logical operators that correspond to the two logical qubits that you can encode on the torus. And so one quick thing that I want to highlight here is that the toric code is a quantum error correcting code. And so we can take advantage of this property by doing what is the so-called error detection. So we can measure the raw values for these expectation values, but then we can also post-select only on those repetitions where the stabilizers had the proper expectation values, and only measure the expectation values of these operators on those repetitions. And you see that these are the error corrected values, and you see that we get much higher expectation values. That's just the property of the quantum error correcting code. Okay, so with this, I concluded the second experiment. And what I wanted to convey with these few slides is just that this new tool of being able to move the atoms while preserving coherence can actually allow us to transport entanglement through the system, and actually allows us to implement a wide new range of quantum architectures. Okay, with this, I just want to show you one quick slide on outlooks. So what are the next things that we would like to do? First of all, we would like to introduce local single site addressing. Everything I showed you so far used a global addressing of all the atoms to the Rydberg state. So they're all coupled simultaneously to the Rydberg state. But if we want to have more flexible architectures, we could introduce local addressing in order to be able to control locally the qubits. This would be merged together with this dynamically reconfigurable entanglement that I just showed you, and with fast atom state detection. And these three things together would actually give a big boost towards implementing quantum error correction architectures, but also this would give us new tools for the exploration of quantum antibody phases. Together with that, we would like to develop and test hardware efficient error detection and correction schemes, where the idea is that instead of using a general purpose error correcting algorithm, we could use architectures that are tailored to the type of errors and also to the strengths of this particular setup. Another thing that I quickly mentioned was developing hybrid approaches that combine analog and digital quantum dynamics. And an example is what I briefly mentioned about the measurement of entanglement entropy. So we do an analog quantum dynamics of our state, but then we perform gate-based measurements that give us access to new observables, as for example, entanglement entropy. And so with this, we really think that these new tools would allow us to explore new directions in the study of many body phases, but also of robust quantum computation. So with this, I want to conclude with two last slides. The first one is just to show you what happened to our experiment during the pandemic. So this is how I was looking at my experiments for most of the past year and a half. Yes, I see there is a question. I see a raised hand. I don't know.
Hello. This fascinating talk, this idea of dynamically configurable entanglement is really fascinating. I have to think about it. It's new. Mm-hmm. And here you use the intrinsic degree of freedom of the Rydberg atoms, like nuclear spin or electron spin. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the first part of your talk, you did not use any internal degree of freedom of the Rydberg atom. Am I right?
So you, in both cases, we do in the sense that we encode the qubit ground. Oh. So in the first part, we encode the qubit, that's what, the spin one-half degree of freedom in the ground and in the Rydberg state. Whereas in this case, we encode the qubit in the zero in two hyperfine states, but then we use the excitation to the Rydberg state just to mediate entanglement. That's the difference. You're always using some internal degree of freedom.
In the first part of the talk, at the end of the day, the valence bonds or the dimers have no other degree of freedom, right? Because you are trying to create coherent superposition of their center of mass degree of freedom only. Am I right?
Well, the dimer correspond to an excitation to the Rydberg state, right?
Okay.
So you're using that internal degree of freedom.
To create an excited state.
Yeah, to create the dimers.
But finally, when you look at the level of the wave functions, they do not appear, okay. Thank you. Yeah. You have given us a lot of things to think about, a lot of homework. Thank you.
Okay. So yeah, no, I just wanted to show you this because I think it's interesting. So over the past year and a half, we've had to work from home for long periods of time. And so we were very lucky to be able to connect everything in our lab online such that we could control the experiment remotely. And this is how the last day we were allowed at Harvard before the lockdown. And you can see that we were fairly exhausted, but pretty happy because we managed to do it. And so for the following several months, we were able to run the experiments from home. And actually all the spin liquids data that you saw were taken from my home. So that's how it happened, which is really cool. This is us again, where we could finally meet outside socially distanced in the summer. And with this, I just want to acknowledge all the people that were involved in this project that I talked to you about today. So this is the experimental team here, my amazing colleagues. Here are the PIs that are involved with the experiment, in particular particular, Misha is the leading person here. And as you can see, we have a big team of theory collaborators, especially for the spin liquid experiment. We really needed that. And in particular on that, I want to thank Ruben and Hannes, who were invaluable collaborators for that project. That would have never have happened without them. So with this, I want to thank you, and I'm happy to take any more questions that you have.
Thank you, Julia. Very nice talk. So any more questions for Julia?
Julia, I have a brief question.
Sure.
So when you create this Rydberg excited atoms, they are, as you say, they are very big. Mm-hmm. Are they spherical? Because depending if you go from a ground state, which is S to P-like, mm-hmm. then there will be directional character of the Rydberg state.
These are S states, so they are spherical.
So they are S state, okay.
Yeah.
And so in principle, if you use P state or other, then they will have like directional character that also could be exploited.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Tarun, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, this was a very exciting talk. I had a couple of questions. One question is, so in this adiabatic preparation where you start from some product state and try to create a record, like ground state, so one would think that the larger the system, the harder it should be at if I fix the rate of the adiabatic movement because you're preparing some state which is, I don't know, which generally requires very, whose depth of circuit should be very large, as I mean, should be proportional to the system size. So did you do any finite size scaling and see that preparing it for larger and larger system is harder and harder at a fixed rate?
So we cannot do much of that in the sense that we don't have much room to do the scaling, in the sense that if you prepare a too small system, basically you are limited by the boundaries. You have boundary effects, and so the spin liquid would only develop in the boundary, and so if it's too small, you don't have the spin liquid. And mm-hmm. this is, and so we don't have enough range to do an actual finite size scaling. But mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. From other experiments, for example, on the square lattice and things like that, we do know that. So the tricky part of this quite about state preparation is that at some point you cross a point where the gap becomes minimum. Right. And that is worse as the system grows. So I think you're exactly right. We cannot probe that too much in the experiment because we don't have a big range where we can explore, but I think you're absolutely right.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
So in this non-trivial topologically ordered phase, my understanding is that it's a odd Z2 gauge theory because number of dimers is odd per sites. And so that doesn't, let me ask the question. So the question I had is that there's this prediction that that the excitations will carry non-trivial momentum, like the Wison mm-hmm. will carry, for example, momentum pi. Is there a way to probe the dynamics of your excitations of this? For example, I mean, as you know, that spin liquid, we have excitation like spin-ons and Wisons, like mm-hmm. fluxes and the, can you probe, for example, their band structure? How do they move around?
The first question is, I don't know if we have Wisons and spinons in this specific. So I think the excitations you get here at these anions, I don't know if I know very little about topological physics, so this is my this was my initiation to this thing, so I might be wrong. There is a anyway in general, is there a way to measure the band structure? It's not trivial, but things like that have been done in other cold atom experiments, so I would guess in principle yes. We would need to figure out exactly how. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think in principle, this should be possible because things like that have been done in other mm-hmm. atom experiments during like Bragg spectroscopy where mm-hmm. you can detect momentum and energy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think I will, if there's time at the end, I will ask one or two sure. more questions, but I will stop now so that other people will ask
questions. Yeah, any more questions? Anybody else? Well, I guess you can ask another question.
So the last part of the talk, this configurable and time, which was very exciting. So the question I had is that there's this, can you prepare ground state of what I would call like a k-local Tory code where you have the Hamiltonian is same as Tory code, like product of, let's say, 4σz and 4σx's, but you don't, but those spins which participate in these interactions, they are not necessarily geometrically local. So they can be anywhere in the space. So consider like a bunch of spins and pick, let's say, randomly pick 4 of them, let's say.
Okay.
And add a Tory code-like interaction between them, σz, 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 or similarly add sigma xtrem for some of these. So it's basically you kind of, it's like scramble the real space information you had, where they were located in a lattice. To me, is it fair to say that you can prepare such states because you could?
From your explanation, I would say yes, because you can connect. I mean, with these movements, you can connect any two atoms that you want in the system. So, you just need to write down what are the kind of movements that you want to do, etc. But in principle, yes, it should be feasible.
I see. Well, that has a lot of. At least my understanding is that some of these k-local like Tory code version of those can encode very many qubits, very many topological qubits, not just few. So have you thought about that?
I don't know anything about these k-local Tory codes, so I will read about it. But if you have any specific ideas, I'm happy to, to talk about this. Yeah.
And one other question I had was, how hard is it to do three-dimensional lattices, for example, pyrochlore lattice or these diamond models, the first part of the talk. Can you prepare a diamond model, let's say, on a pyrochlore lattice, three dimensions, which is corner shading, tetrahedra?
So the creation of three-dimensional Twitter arrays has been demonstrated by this group in Palaiseau. It is kind of hard. I mean, it's quite harder. The experimental complexity becomes serious. And so I don't think we're going to go for that in the near future. But part of the motivation why we didn't think of doing that anytime soon is because it didn't seem like there was anything. I mean, a lot of interesting physics happened in 2D anyway. And so we were like, okay, let's stick to this. But if there was something that 3D would really enable that it's not visible in 2D, we might think about it. So if you have a specific idea again,
one obvious thing which maybe most people in the audience are so many more experts than me, just you can get phases which are not possible in 2D. One obvious thing is a photon phase. You can have a analog of electrodynamics where they are photons, which are linear dispersing, like energy proportional to momentum. So that's not possible in 2D very easily. I mean, if you can, then you have in 2D, if you want to do that, you need much more stuff, but it's in 3D, it's like our world right now, it's 3D and we have photons. So those kind of phases where there's a, there's a lot of work on that from early 2000s by, I don't know, people in Santa Barbara, for example. Which are not possible in 2D, including fractal phases, for example.
My idea for the near future is maybe we could try something where you don't have a full 3D geometry, but you have a few planes. So you could do a little bit of that. But I don't know, we could talk about it. I think experimentally is pretty complex. And so it's hard for any experimentalist to pull the trigger on that. Even this group in Palaiseau that demonstrated it, they did it, but they didn't do any physics with it. They just showed that it's possible. So, but if there is a good motivation, I think it might be. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Thanks again for
raising.
Wang, go ahead.
Yeah, so it's related to that 3D question. So can you not use this transport idea in 2D to generate this 3D ground states?
To some degree, I think yes. But for example, if you want to do something like, for example, what we did with the historic code was to create a 3D geometry with a 2D array. I think if you want to do something more in a quantum simulation sense, as the first experiment, you want all the interactions to be there at the same time. Basically, this works very well for this gate-based ideas. If you want an analog dynamics, I think it's not that easy. I mean, you cannot do the same thing. Okay. Maybe there is a way you can think of doing the state preparation that is like based on entangling gates and things like that. So I guess in some limits it might be possible. I don't know if it's general. So
I see. So what you're saying is that you need to come up with a kind of like a gate-based preparation.
Exactly. Something like that. And yeah.
I see.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Well, if not, thank you, Julia, once again for a very nice and very stimulating talk.
Thank you.
And so we will see everyone in 2 weeks, I guess. We're skipping next week due to March meeting.
Okay.
See you. Thank you very much.
Nice to meet you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for a great talk.
Thank you.